Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Let's close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure.
It's actually another exciting second hour.
Do we have two episodes or do we have one each week?
It's episodic. I'm not sure. It's like it pops in and out. So
okay. Here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of this week's episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure.
But doesn't that imply that the first hour was exciting? I'm not sure I would meet that criteria.
I don't think so.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, for another mediocrely exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach.
Is it a criteria or a criterium? Mm. I think it would not meet because it's one. It's not multiple. Criteria is multiple.
Yeah.
It's kind of like data is a plural word.
Or millennium.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah,
something like that.
Latin.
So
in
this
English form.
Telephone number in here is 254-773-1400 if you'd like to inject some sense into what we're doing. I wanted to talk about a couple of things that I think are important. One of them is the fact that on September 14th, you're probably aware, there was an attack which we're now officially recognizing that came from Iran.
Yep.
That hit
on Saudi Arabia.
Two different sites in Saudi Arabia. And there were a whole bunch of cruise missiles. There were at least 7 cruise missiles, and there were at least 14 drones involved in that attack. And it took out 5% of the world oil supply. It took out half of Saudi Arabia's capacity to supply oil to the West.
And then immediately afterwards, well, I guess on Friday, they said, we will react in a broad measure if anyone attacks us.
Here's the big deal. I'm old enough. This is Jeff. I'm old enough to remember when the tanker war cracked up in the 1980s, and I'm old enough to remember
remember that time frame, but it's more about watching Smurfs on television.
I'm old enough to remember the 1973 event when OPEC cut the oil off to the United States. And I know that in the 1980s, we had a collapse, that we had a restriction on oil flows to Western Europe and the United States. It was about as severe as the one we got on September 14th. The price of oil doubled and the stock market collapsed. Interest rates shot up. I mean, we had so many things happening that it was a big piece of what triggered the recession at that point. This time, we had half of Saudi Arabia's oil supply suddenly cut off, with the immediate potential for a major war in the Gulf that would cut off all the oil that flows out of the Gulf, the Persian Gulf, depending on what you want to call it. Let's just call it the Persian Gulf, the rest of the world. And the price of oil went from about $56, West Texas oil, we'll use that as a benchmark, to about $62 and then drop back to $58. The stock market, if you look on September 14th and try to find something that happened in the stock market during that period, it just kind of went blip up, blip down, blipped up, blip down, and that was it. The world's changed, and it's changed so phenomenally, and I think we just don't appreciate something. And that is the way that capitalism and supply and demand works. Oil went to $100 a barrel at one point. And it went to $100 a barrel in the midst of a period of time in which people were talking about peak oil and the fact that we've actually used up all the available oil, and from now on it's downhill, and oil will be $1,000 a barrel, and we're going to run out of oil, and the world's going to come to an end, and all of that was just a few years ago.
Well, I'm going to come in and say something that may rock your boat a little bit.
Okay, the world is coming to an end?
No, September 14th. Do you know what the reaction in the market was?
What was the reaction in the market?
The market remained shut all day long. But it was Saturday.
Okay, Monday.
Right, so the reaction was we continued our weekend.
We continued our weekend. Well, the markets around the rest of the world, some of which were still open, did not have major reactions. And Monday, it was like it didn't happen.
Right, right.
So the point is, what I'm trying to say is that we had this major event that previously would have produced an economic shock that echoed around the world, probably would have put the United States economy, considering where it is right now,
into recession.
Into a recession.
And it didn't this time. Didn't even come close.
It was a non-event. And in the 1980s, even into the 90s and in the early 2000s, we knew, it was widely accepted among geologists, that the largest oil reserves in the world were in the United States. They were just locked up in shale.
And there's no way you could get it out.
It was impossible to get it out economically.
Or if you got it out, it would be so expensive nobody would ever pay for it.
And here we are with oil at $58 a barrel.
Which is significantly more than it was, but inflation adjusted, maybe only about twice as expensive as it was back then.
I don't know that it's any more expensive than it was back then. Basically, if I go to
let me clarify that. Oil by weight, by gallon, is about twice as expensive. But fuel efficiency is twice as much,
now,
too.
Now, have you taken inflation into account?
I have.
Okay.
Yeah, because it went from about $10 a barrel back then to $58 now. So that's almost a six-time appreciation, except that with inflation in place, if you take inflation out, it's only about $20 a barrel. But fuel efficiency has increased by more than double in the same time period. So oil is actually cheaper now based on the efficiency of how we use it than it was then.
The reason I say that is I've looked at the inflation since I was in high school. And the value of the dollar has changed by a factor of about 10.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
So what you're saying is you're really old.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Gasoline was 35 cents a gallon. In other words, for gasoline to be the same price today as it was when I was in high school.
I have to make sure that we're talking true stories here. Was it uphill both ways?
No.
No. Okay.
It was just 35 cents a gallon.
Okay.
Now, unless of course, you went to Shamrock where it was $29.9. It was very common to go get a dollar's worth of gasoline.
Woo.
That would get you roughly 3 gallons. And, of course, before I can vaguely remember when it was 20 cents, but I wasn't driving at that point. I was very intensely aware of the price of gasoline when I was in high school because I was driving a car where I had to pay for the gasoline.
Right, right.
And I didn't have much money.
And now it's 10 times that.
It's 10 times that, but inflation has increased approximately 10 times. So gas is still the same price as it was.
Sort of.
In 1967.
Because I get premium gas, and you're getting up close to the 260, 270 range.
It would have to be $3.50 a gallon to be the same price.
Yeah, I'm not sure the exact time frame of your numbers, but I could put those into our system.
1967 to the present.
Okay, I'll plug those numbers in because what I was looking at is the 1950s, even up into the 1980s. The usage of oil and the efficiency of oil has made it cheaper to be using it now on a per cost basis, on a per weight.
You're being too much of an economist. I'm just being a guy who buys gasoline.
Let me see how many hands. On the other hand, I have fingers.
That's a big thing. Now, there's something else that's emerging here. One of the reasons leading economic indicators was at zero rather than a negative number. And one of the things that's causing the Federal Reserve and economists to say, well, maybe we're not going to have a recession after all, is the fact that housing starts jumped in August like 12%.
Yeah, and because they've been abysmally low for a summertime period. But then we look in at, wait a minute, what houses started?
And it's multifamily housing. What that means is apartment buildings. And there's a lot of apartment buildings suddenly popping up. Now, this is very, very different from a couple deciding to buy a house or even a builder deciding to build a house on spec and getting a mortgage, a 30-year mortgage on the house. This is a very, very different environment. These are commercial loans, and I don't think it's at all a coincidence that suddenly the banks ran short on cash following the incident of a lot of builders borrowed a lot of money to build a lot of multifamily houses. Now, let's back up a second to the 80s again for a second. We had a housing crisis in 1991. It started in the 80s, and it accumulated to 1991.
Where trust corporations, savings and loan problems,
And the biggest piece of that was building multifamily housing. So I decided to see if maybe office buildings were also being built. And sure enough, there's a surge in office building too. The banks are loaning money. Somebody is loaning money, a lot of money, to pop a bubble in the real estate. Let me get this out here. This is a very, very important issue here, I think, when you're looking at the big picture of what's going on. We are on the early stages of developing a bubble in the real estate market. And why are we developing a bubble in the real estate market?
Not
in residential. Because interest rates are very, very low. And why are interest rates low? This is not political. It's because of tariffs. Tariffs are holding the economy back. The Federal Reserve is lowering interest rates to accommodate the fact that the economy is decelerating because of tariffs, and every economist agrees on that point. The president wants the Federal Reserve to lower interest rates to zero to spur on the economy to offset the fact that he is waging a trade war, whether you like the trade war or don't like the trade war. He is waging a trade war against China that is hurting the economy. And he wants the Federal Reserve to accommodate that by lowering interest rates. Why is the Federal Reserve not lowering interest rates? It's really simple. If you lower them a lot.
Right.
Actually, they may have lowered them too much. And by the way, that's what I got this from Bullard, the Federal Reserve bank.
Chicago
Bank. He said the bubbles are already starting to form because of low interest rates.
Yeah.
And he is concerned that we'll get back into the same mess we've got into twice in my lifetime, where the banks and money was being loaned at very low interest rates. People couldn't find anything else to do with the money, so they began to slam it into real estate investments, large multifamily housing and office buildings, without regard to whether there was anybody to fill those office buildings or the rental properties. There may or may not be, but the point is, this is where we get in trouble. If these loans are made and they're low interest rate loans and they're sold and then interest rates go back up again in the future, then the value of those loans drops and whoever is holding the loan lose money.
Yeah. So if you're a bank and you've given the loan, the value of that loan drops when interest rates go up. If you get your assets by making loans and then taking those same loans and selling them to other banks – but sometimes you sit on the loans. Oh, this is a pretty good one. I'll sit on this one for a while. You can wind up losing a lot of money in that operation.
Even if you sell it, whoever bought it from you winds up losing the money.
Right.
This is where there is a risk in the economy right now because of low interest rates. You're probably wondering, why doesn't Chairman Powell just do what the president asked him to do and lower interest rates to zero, goose the economy back up again? The reason is it produces bubbles when you do that.
Yeah.
And we've been through what happened with a real estate bubble when interest rates were lower, trying to goose the economy. We've been through this time and time again.
The reality is that the Federal Reserve doesn't have the kind of tools necessary to offset tariffs, because the Federal Reserve has never been given those tools. When the Federal Reserve was founded was right at the same time period that we got off tariffs and went to the income tax. All of their tool base is built around a very predictable system of when taxes are due and when it's going to come in and out of the system. All that stuff is, I mean, we got deadlines and these happen, and the vast majority of people actually make their deadlines. This is the issue with the tariff, is that not only is it unknown, and this is a fascinating thing here, currently there is no compendium, even at the governmental level, in one place that holds all the tariffs. If you're about to import something you want to build, you in essence have to hire a trade attorney to figure out what the tariffs may be on that import. And it's due at the import process. So you can't order it and say, what is it going to be then? You have to pay in essence, paid the tariff in advance of the shipment so that it makes it through customs. That means that there is a lag time. Even if we go to this as a normal system, as if we say, well, let's get off the income tax and go back to tariffs. This is something I really enjoy talking about, the wealth of nations, the creation of capitalism, kind of whole cloth, by Adam Smith, the father of capitalism. The journal, the compendium of these books, deals primarily with one subject: the appropriate application of tariffs. The way this trade war is being run is not following that book at all. There's no certainty or anything going forward. If we had deadlines that we set and then kept, and we're not doing that, it's part of the negotiation process. So we're using tariffs to settle a trade dispute, and that is an appropriate use of tariffs. The appropriate method of doing it is the next step, and that's where the problem is. It's not being well communicated to the business community what their costs are going to be for doing business, and that's the bottom line. That's the thing. If a business knows what the expenses are going to be, they can make decisions. If they don't, they would rather wait. And that's just all the way down to the smallest businesses, all the way up to the largest businesses. If you don't know what your costs are going to be, you don't make the investment. If somebody said, would you like to buy this house? Commit to buy it. Sign this contract right here. The house may or may not be worth twice as much or half as much at the time of sale. Figure it out. It's really hard to make that decision. If you want to buy a house, you want to agree on the price at the beginning. And that's the issue with trade, is that we need to know what the prices are in order to make trades. And that's the reason for the trade war. So that's kind of across the board the issue.
I know that's going to sound really weird and esoteric.
As opposed to what we've been saying all along here. This entire program is really weird and esoteric.
But any of you, if you don't understand finance and bonds, then that's okay. Just take my word for what I'm about to say. Or you can look it up. If you do understand it, this will be, it's an interesting thing to look into. The mortgage bond duration in the United States jumped 27% last week.
Okay, can I tell them what duration is, because that's going to really bug people.
It's a measure of risk.
Okay, well, let me tell you how it works. Imagine a seesaw, and the seesaw has money, like pennies, put about every inch or so along the seesaw. But all the way on one side, there's a huge stack of pennies. Find where the balance point is on that seesaw, and that is the duration. That big stack of pennies all the way on one side is the maturity of a loan, if it's like a bond. It's going to pay you the entire principal all at once. So that big stack of pennies weights the bond towards maturity on the duration side. And the closer you are to maturity, the smaller the duration, the less the risk, because you're going to get this money back. If it's a guaranteed loan from the government, you're about to have the totality of the principal value of that original loan come back to you. So it removes a lot of the risk. So go ahead. Sorry.
Basically, that means the risk in the total mortgage bond market in the United States. Now, mortgage bonds don't just include houses. Matter of fact, that's not the biggest piece. The biggest piece of it right now is multifamily housing, the thing that surged in construction.
Right.
Our starts. And the risk jumped 27% last week. Now, that is one of those little indicators that you probably never heard of and probably will never hear of again. But it's one of the things that leads me to say that we are on a cusp, on an edge in the United States economy right now.
We could go either way.
There's a lot of instability out there. And
we still say that if the tariffs went away, if somehow we got a resolution, if the president had a complete success right now and got a trade deal, the economy would be booming again, or at least would start recovering very quickly. Decisions would start to be made. But that likelihood is getting smaller and smaller. And he said something on Friday about we may not have a trade deal before the election, which means that we've got another at least a full year of this uncertainty.
I'm actually at the point right now, I was saying earlier that if he suddenly declared the trade war over with,
then the tariffs all went away.
I don't know. I think we may be past the point of stabilizing.
I don't know, because the consumers are still spending. And if we get a big Christmas sale, in essence, the trade war's done. The prices have all come back to what they were supposed to be before. And a big Christmas sale across the board, that may cause a full movement forward into expansion again.
But in order to expand, the consumer would have to increase their spending more than they're currently spending.
It's true.
And that means they would have to borrow more money on their credit cards, and their credit cards are already at the point where we shouldn't be borrowing more money.
We're due for a recession either way. So even with but it might push back when the recession occurs. If it's 12 to 18 months, trade war going away may make it more like 18 to 24. That's my thought on it. We're still due for a recession. And without the trade war, we would have gotten a recession too. It may have been a little bit longer in coming. But not a great deal longer.
And it would have been less severe.
Yeah. So what we're saying here is that the recession coming on when it does is directly related to the trade war, but we were going to have one soon anyway. We're in a maturing economy, and that's what you get at the end of a maturing economy is you get a recession so that you can have a retraction, and then the expansion begins again. And this is the cycle. It's like weather.
Mm-hmm, right.
Winter comes followed by spring, giving summer a miss and going directly into fall. Sorry, Monty Python snuck in.
Here's the point we're concerned about, not the recession. If we get a normal cyclical recession, which it looks like we're going to get, that's cool. What I'm concerned about, Jeff McClure, at this point, I think you probably are too, is that any activity that tries to put this recession off severely, in other words, dumping a lot of water on the,
right.
on the fire.
There's no governmental action right now or even Federal Reserve action right now that would probably be appropriate for that.
If we took dramatic action in some way, a sudden tax cut, which was proposed by the Trump administration,
right.
and withdrawn.
Right.
And I think that's probably why it was withdrawn. We would be in the position of exacerbating the recession than when it finally comes. Anything that pushes it's kind of like Wile E. Coyote. The further he runs off the bluff, off the mesa, and he keeps running.
Just don't look down.
The further he goes, the bigger the fall is going to be.
If he would stop carrying the signs, he would never fall. It's the act of taking out the sign, I think, that causes him to fall through the air.
You know, I don't even know that they run those cartoons anymore, which is a lot of people won't understand what we're talking about. Anyway, this is the Personal Wealth Coach. The telephone number in here is 254-773-1400. There's actually something else somewhere, I'm sure, that we would be willing to talk about at this
point. I've got a fantastic subject, and it goes directly to education. We're going to get out of the macro effects. It is investment-related, but it's in the types of investment. The 529 plan. A lot of people are talking about college and college costs going up, maybe college costs going down. 529 plans have been a place that people have been putting money for their kids to go to college because they can take the money out and the gains are tax-free if all the rules are followed and the money is used for college. Well, now the expansion to that from 2017, you're allowed to spend up to $10,000 a year in K-12 education as well. So that's pretty cool. There's another little subset here that's really interesting, especially for someone who knows or cares for someone with special needs. A 529 plan can be rolled over into something called an ABLE plan. Are you familiar with these?
No.
ABLE, it's relatively new. It came out in 2014. But it wasn't hyped, and the states had to make a plan for their 529s to assist it. So what is an ABLE plan? Congress passed it, and of course ABLE stands for something, so they put an acronym together. I'm sure there's a team of bureaucrats. Their only job is to find acronyms appropriate to the title of the bill. The Achieving a Better Life Experience Act of 2014. And basically what it does is there's different rules for each state. Some of the states share rules, but it allows people with special needs that when they're diagnosed, they can roll over their 529 into this plan. And this plan then acts in a way very similar in many ways to a special needs trust. Up to $100,000 in this position is exempt from state financial aid, Medicaid. So if somebody's got special needs and you've been planning for their college and suddenly the special needs really rear up, there's a solution here, and it's just started to be picked up by the major financial organizations with the state. So it's only been 5 years since the act was passed. So it's nice to see it happening. Another thing is that 529s are being used in a different way as well. A lot of, and I've been seeing this regularly over the past several years, grandparents wanting to give their kids or their grandkids money while they're still alive to watch them enjoy it. And 529 plan allows you to take 5 years of your gift exemption and concentrate it into 1 year. Now, you can't give that gift to that same child over the next 5 years, but if there's two of you, grandparents, you can put $150,000 into a 529 plan for a kid, and then watch them go to school on that money. So there are some new tools that are being developed. We've been concentrating on all the tools that are out there, and some of them have faults, and some of them are broken, and some of them are working perfectly. This is a new tool, and it's a fascinating one because it's allowing something that it's kind of hard to look around and find similarities. This is a direct investment in education, which has a long-term, amazingly positive benefit to the economy. This is cool. If you can afford to put money in a 529 plan for your kid, I would say it's a really good idea in most cases. If you believe they have special needs or they might have special needs and you're afraid that they may lose out on some benefits and so you don't want to put money in a 529 for them, it may be a better idea to put money in a 529 in that case, because then in the future you may be able to immediately roll that into an ABLE plan. The drawback on 529s is that if you don't use them for education, the gains on them become taxable and sometimes they have a penalty. So just keep that in mind. It is locking it in for education, but that's how you get that awesome tax advantage. If you're planning on spending money on education anyway, then it's a fantastic route to go. All right, that was my sidestep to the next subject. I hope you enjoyed. Do you want to play some commercials?
Sure.
Okay. We'll be back on the other side of these fantastic words from our sponsors and public service announcements. And if you would like to join the conversation, the phone number to call in here is 254-773-1400. We'll be back.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Telephone number in here, 254-773-1400. Could I throw something in completely on a different subject?
All right, let me plug Salado again real quick, and then we'll jump into that.
Is it leaking?
It is. Yes, we have to plug it quickly. Today in Salado, if you're listening in Texas, and some of you are not, and you can just bemoan that fact, there is a wine and culinary festival occurring all weekend, but today specifically, there's a lot of good stuff going on, specifically at Salado Winery, the north end of Main Street. There is a grape stomp and wine festival happening there. A grape stomp meaning that there's a competition to see who can stomp the most juice out of grapes. And it's a series of competitions. If that sounds fun to you, By the way, feet washing is happening afterwards. You don't have to worry about sticky feet for the rest of the day, unless you just like sticky feet. I do think it'd be a great idea to head to Salado today. Something for most people. I wouldn't say everyone. Most people.
Yeah.
Okay. Sense. And now, back to you, sir.
You probably heard an old saw that was generated in the late 1990s.
What did it sound like? Was it like...
Pretty close, pretty close. It was John Bogle who said it, and it has been repeated so many, many times that actively managed mutual funds.
Yeah. Talking about Morningstar's news this week.
Versus passive index funds, and that index funds outperform 85% of actively managed funds. By the way, that was false at the time. It's still false.
No. It's true for actively managed funds, just not true for actively managed funds in the indexes that they're trying to compete with.
It's not necessarily a false statement, but it's definitely misleading. Morningstar reported over the 12-month ending June 29th, 48% of actively managed funds, when measured against the index...
Of their choice, but
of the same... In other words, if they're in large-cap blend fund stocks, for example, and then you'd use the S&P 500. 48% of actively managed funds outperformed their index, their appropriate index funds.
That means... Almost half. About the average manager outperformed their index.
And
or their category.
23% of actively managed funds outperformed the index against which they are measured over the last 10 years. Now, when you consider that, that's not a really good measurement, because if you were to...
How many of those funds have been around for that long?
If you back off and say... 23% of them outperform their index. How many of them still have the same managers? The ones that have the same managers bring it up. If you say, okay, let's just take the funds that for the last 10 years have had one set of managers, we're back up to 50% again.
Yeah.
So basically, even after the fact that indexes don't have cash in them and they don't have a lot of the restrictions that active funds have cash in them, and they don't have a lot of the restrictions, and index funds don't have a lot of the restrictions that are in actively managed funds, which makes it a little bit of an uneven playing field. About half of the actively managed funds are outperforming the indexes. And I know that may be a shock, because the other thing that came out that Morningstar announced...
Yeah.
Is that index funds now have more money for the first time than actively managed funds. And it is really odd, because there's this general belief that index funds always outperform actively managed funds.
It's simply not true.
Now, there are some cases where when we go to look in a given asset class for a fund, an active fund, and we've got, let's say, two we're already using, we can't find a third one because the very, very good ones have closed to new investors. And we have to use an index fund because the index fund is the third best available performer.
Or in cases where there are whole asset classes that we look at that an index is the same as active. So, for instance, in the short-term bond market.
Right.
There's not a lot of difference. If you just say, all right, these are all going to be really high quality, it's not that different index versus active. But when you're talking about actively managed mid-cap positions in the value or growth area. What I said earlier about the statistic being true, it is true. It's just that the vast majority of active funds are not against the index that the overall surveys were measuring them against. So there are a lot of conflicting surveys here as well. What you just said is the most concise statement, and it wasn't very concise, that I've heard on the subject, period. So we got to figure out how to clarify that to say...
It boils down to something very simple. You can't just blanket say active is better or passive is better.
That is correct. That's the concise way of saying it.
The issue is to take a look, first use asset classes when you're investing. That's what the science of portfolio management says to use. Secondly, when you choose the asset class that you should have in the fund or in your portfolio, choose several, because they can blow up. Individual funds can do unpleasant things suddenly and unexpectedly. And you take a look at that, and you look at their history, and you look at their management. It isn't as simple as you might think. You might, well, I'll just grab an index fund in this area over here, and I'll be cool. That doesn't work that way. For example, let me give you another extreme example of why it doesn't work. The S&P 500 index funds at Vanguard or any place, T. Rowe Price or someplace where they're very inexpensive, have done very, very well recently. There's no question about that. But had you invested in one of those index funds in 2000 and you adjust for inflation, it would have taken 13 years for you to break even. Not a good place to put a lot of your money unless you're willing to be in a loss position for 13 consecutive years before you break even. There's a lot more to this than meets the eye, but when I saw this statistic come out from Morningstar, I thought, this is one of those things that I've seen again and again and again. Basically, when I look at a list of performance by mutual fund in their category, whatever category they happen to be in, and they are a widely used category, for instance, small cap growth or a large cap growth or whatever, and when I put them together, almost inevitably, the cheap index funds come out at the 50th percentile. I mean, very consistently come out at the 50th percentile, which means about half the funds over a long period of time that are out there that aren't index funds are outperforming.
So long as they have the same manager over that entire
right. Let's filter out the fact that when a manager changes, the fund changes. So the fund has to exist, and therefore the manager has to have been in place for 10 years.
Right.
We take a look at that, and almost inevitably, and interestingly enough, with that's exactly where I would expect the index fund to be, right in the middle, because about half the actively managed funds are absurdly expensive.
Yeah, and when you think about this for just a second, another term for the index is the average.
Right.
To have it be directly in the middle makes sense. It's the average, and those active investors in those active mutual funds are buying and selling things. If they're trying to beat an index and the index is invested in the same things, the active funds performance in there of buying and selling what they're buying and selling improves the index's return.
And this is another interesting point here. Now, expenses are still very, very important. Low expense funds outperform high expense funds, generally speaking.
Especially if they're the same manager.
But I'll give you a couple of examples here. Pareto's principle works here. And you haven't heard of Pareto's principle,
the 80-20
rule. Yeah. There's going to be about 20% of the funds in any given category, if there's a lot of funds in a category, that are going to do exceptionally well. And there's going to be about 4% of them that do exceptionally well, 20% of 20%. And you look at, for instance, the Vanguard company. Vanguard is famous. John Bogle founded it and was the chairman and CEO for many, many years.
He called the alarm on index funds being too big about 2 weeks before his death.
The point that is emphatically needs to be made here is the best performing funds over the long term at Vanguard are actively managed funds. The majority of John Bogle's money was in actively managed funds at Vanguard. Now, what did those actively managed funds have in common?
Not index funds. Bogle was not investing in index funds.
He was investing some, but he released a financial statement, or the SEC did, by accident one time, and it got out, and we saw where his money was invested. And the majority of his money was invested in actively managed funds at Vanguard, mind you, that were very low-cost funds, but were actively managed, and they over the long term were the best performers at Vanguard, and that's where he put his money. It's one of those things that this is myth busting 101 when it comes to investing in mutual funds or ETFs. Right. By the way, another thing, people say ETFs have just got to be the greatest thing in the world, and there's this move from mutual funds to ETFs. ETFs have the potential to be dangerous. You really need to do some research before you jump into an ETF as opposed to a mutual fund to make sure it's insured, not insured, but covered, that is registered under the Investment Company Act of 1940, and look at the background and the company that issues it. Remember, you're not just trading something on the market. You're trading something that is supported by an underlying company, and are they willing, and able to support that fund?
Right.
The other thing about ETFs, and this was amazing to me, I was looking at expenses the other day. ETFs are famous for being low cost. And I was looking at Vanguard, but that's not to say it's not true. It's some other company too. It may very well be. Some of their regular funds, where they have ETFs and they have funds, the funds are less expensive than the ETFs.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's getting to be normal because the fund company does come in and support those funds occasionally when they're being purchased above the value of their underlying assets. And that's getting into a complicated area. But the fund company is required to sit there with some assets on hand if they're doing it correctly.
And there's another little factor I wanted to throw in here. It isn't bit anybody that I know of yet, but that's not to say it can't. And that is when there is a no transaction fee ETF being offered by a company.
Ooh.
Where they're not charging you anything to do the transaction.
Somebody's getting paid, I guarantee it.
They have a no cost exchange traded fund. In other words, the internal costs for the fund are zero.
Yeah. The big one that announced that, and I'm going to have to look this up, I believe it was after 6 months. The internal expense rate went from zero to a significant amount, and that's how they were paying for that zero.
And this is an important thing to recognize. You're in uncharted territory here because they're still making money on those funds. And how are they making money? They are loaning your shares, which they can't do with a mutual fund, but they can do with an ETF because it is like a stock. They can loan your shares out to short sellers.
These are people that sell shorts,
right,
on the highway.
They can actually loan the shares out and receive interest on the loan on the fund that you think you own, that you think is in your account, the
right.
shares.
Yeah.
And
it depends on the ETF because some of them are Investment Company Act products and some of them are not.
And so
you got to read the fine print.
We haven't been through a financial crisis with ETFs where there was a lot of ETFs
yet.
Loaned out to see what would happen if people couldn't cover their loaned out ETFs. I know what happens is the fund, the brokerage firm where, let's say, Schwab or whatever, and I'm not particularly picking on Schwab, but Schwab was one of the first people to come out with this, or Fidelity, loans, you say you have 1,000 shares of the XYZ ETF, and they loan your 1,000 shares to somebody else. The somebody else then sells them, expecting that they will go down. And then when the crunch comes, like a 1987-style crunch, there's no guarantee they'll be able to repay them. And if they don't repay them, who produces the ETF shares to cover your ETF shares? And that's where you have to be on the alert and recognize that there's a possibility that things could get kind of awkward. Eventually, I suspect if it's a large exchange that's doing this, they eventually will find them someplace, but it may take months for them to find them.
And this is important because this is a response I get. Why is it that they let people do that? Well, they is anyone that's an ETF investor who signed the document
right.
when they opened the account and they bought that particular investment that said, yes, you're allowed to loan out the securities. It's in the contract. It's
yes.
in the prospectus. It's in these things are fully disclosed. That does not make them safe. That's an important little piece to throw out there.
We are in this. All this came to mind for me when we got into this money market scramble.
The repo stuff that we talked about first hour.
This last week. We are in uncharted territory in a lot of areas. We have not encountered a crisis in those areas.
Right.
ETFs is one of them.
Sometimes requires a crisis so that we can figure out how to be safe. We're not doing crash testing in the market.
But the market is continually evolving and creating new products and creating new things and doing things. And unfortunately, a lot of investors are operating on mythologies that are 20 or 30 years old that
right.
no longer apply in the market. And it's very important to be aware, if you're doing your own investing and choosing your own investments, of new risks that appear that weren't there a few years ago.
And if somebody says, hey, are you in ETFs yet? Well, anytime they say, are you in fill in the blank yet, it's a new thing. It wasn't there. That means that you're going to need to spend some time educating yourself on the subject. Do you mind if I jump to the next subject?
Jump.
All right. The Federal Reserve came out with some data this week. Net worth of American households grew in the second quarter. Fantastic. but at a slower rate than the prior quarter. We can dip into
this
that
is
and
way
figure
back
out.
In the second quarter, though.
Yeah.
And here we're almost done with the third quarter.
There's some good information in here, though. This stuff is not stuff that should be a big surprise. The last quarter of last year, we had a downturn. Remember that whole thing where the government wasn't open? Do you remember that?
I do remember
Seems
that.
Seems like it was a decade ago. No, that was just December. We had a downturn. So the growth in the net worth is attributed, there's a big chunk of that was the rise in value of corporate equities held in households. So the gain comes from a 3.3% rise in the value of corporate equities.
You know, I went all the way through our household and tried to find some corporate equities.
Yeah, it's hard to find in a household.
I think
problem.
A Roomba sucked them up.
Okay, so bottom line, second quarter, this is the ending of the last day of June. We're almost to the last day of this quarter, which is the third quarter. The first quarter had a household net worth growth of, we're going to round this up by one one-thousandth of a percent and call it 5%. It's 4.99% growth. Second quarter, 1.64% growth. That's all good, except there's one tiny little piece that's important. Household debt grew 4.26% during that same time period.
That's why I said earlier, stimulating the economy at this point, the one part of the economy that's growing.
Right, is consumer spending.
Yeah, even with a 12.6% jump in housing starts, they're still about 0.5% lower than they were a year ago.
So the spending's going up, household debt going up by 4.26, the net worth still wound up going 1.64. So net worths were still growing, and net worth takes into account debt. But the reason why the growth is so much slower, when wages were up during this time period, net worth grew slower at a time when wages were up higher than in the first quarter. The reason is because people are spending almost as fast as they're making the new money. They're going into debt on this stuff.
And it's important to also recognize that if you have a 4.6% increase in debt in one quarter, you have to multiply that times four.
Yeah, jump out there. You're talking about a 12% increase in debt, and that is over the previous quarter. That is just phenomenal.
And this is why we've been saying further stimulus in the economy, lowering of interest rates, anything to do with stimulating the economy while at the same time holding the economy back with tariffs is like pressing on the accelerator while holding your brakes on. Something is going to give at some point.
Good news in here, household savings rate was still at 8%, 8.03, but it was lower than the 8.49 from the previous quarter. So we're still saving, and that's a good thing. But that's on aggregate. There are a lot of people with no saving. A lot of this stuff is going in the upper income household stuff. So if you've got the opportunity to save right now, take it. Do it. Do not get more loans right now. Get more savings.
I was going to say, if you dig down to that savings rate, it's very, very, very skewed. The higher the income and net worth of the family, the higher their savings rate. So once you get down into the middle group of people in the United States and below, what we've actually seen is a negative savings
rate.
Correct. And the upper income people, as we said earlier, those are in many cases business owners and investors who are very concerned. And so they're the people who are buying treasuries and forcing interest rates down.
And
they're
the consumer spending is at the lower end of the economy
because
they've just gotten raises and they're happy, as they should be. They've worked a freaking decade with their wages being pretty low. Having a wage increase at a rate that you can actually feels good. Celebrate. Don't get me wrong. But in the process, save. Make sure that you get this stuff and recognize that the gravy times are not all times, or they would call all times gravy times. Did I mix another metaphor?
I got you.
I'm going to figure this out. Gravy is somehow money. Don't eat your money. That's the bottom line to all of this. Stop eating your money.
Be aware of something else, too, and that is with the market not rising in the last 12 months, brokers and financial advisors and people who are wearing two hats as an investment advisor and a broker are short on money because they haven't seen a lot of market surges. And as a result, they are doing some things that, for instance, caused Raymond James to pay $15 million for overcharging investors.
Yeah.
And we are seeing we continue to see scams popping up, including in nursing homes, oddly enough.
That was a big one.
And it really boils down to the fact that if you're going to invest in something and you can't find it on Morningstar, you probably ought not to invest in it. And if somebody says, read the prospectus carefully before investing, if you see that someplace, you really ought to. And if you don't understand the prospectus, you probably ought not to invest in it.
And we are about out of time for this week. Thank you very much for listening. I'm only applying that to the people that are actually listening, because if you're not listening, you couldn't hear me. Thank you. So there. We enjoy this. This is the longest amount of time that we get to sit together and have a conversation between father and son during the week, and we really appreciate the opportunity. If you would like to contact us off the air, we have voicemail waiting during the weekend locally at
254-947-1111. We got live people there during the week.
Also toll free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can listen to our recordings of the program going way, way back. You can read our newsletter, see what we had to say about previous issues.
Don't forget the disclaimer that listening to too many podcasts can lower your intelligence.
And go to Salado today. Email us directly at jeff@tpwc.com or